Welcome to the Opium Den Archives. I'm Daniel Williams. Today is August 24th, 2009. Inside the Opium Den today, we are honored and privileged to have one of Canada's most preeminent investigative journalists. Her name is Diane Francis. And as you know, we endeavor to speak to bright and interesting people who are outside the drug policy reform arena. And Diane Francis is outside the drug policy reform arena. I came to the attention of, or Diane came to my attention when she wrote a post, wrote a piece for the National Post in Ontario. She's the editor at large for the Financial Post in Ontario. She is the author of 9 best-selling books. Her most recent bestseller is Who Runs Canada? Diane has been a media fellow at the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland. And for over a year, she was a distinguished visiting professor at Ryerson University's Ryerson Rogers School of Management, which is Canada's largest business school. She's been a member of a number of advisory boards. And like I mentioned, she is the one of the most prominent and most respected investigative journalists in Canada. Diane Francis will be joining us here shortly. So this should be an interesting interview. We're going to give Diane a call right now. She's waiting up in Canada. I spoke to her for a few minutes ago to make sure we were on board. So let's give Diane a call. Here we go. Okay, let's try to make this call. And this isn't working out too well. Well, let's try it again here. Okay. We're going to have to try see what the problem is. Hold on with me for a few seconds here. And Skype's a great thing, but sometimes it just needs a little extra goose, so we're going to put that number in again. Again, we'll be speaking with Diane Francis, the most respected investigative journalist in Canada, and we're going to talk today about the problems of drug prohibition as they relate to Mexico and the United States and Canada. So here we go, calling Diane, and she should be ready to pick up here any minute. Again, you're inside the Opium Den Archives Library. Phone is ringing. And
hello.
Hello, Diane Francis. This is Daniel Williams. Welcome to the Opium Den. How are you this morning?
I'm good. I'm real good.
Well, good. I want to thank you again for taking time from your busy schedule to visit with us and enlighten all of our listeners on what your views are on a couple of issues, primarily the U.S. war on drugs and the repercussions of such. But I want to start off by asking, and I don't mean to put you on the spot or anything, but as I mentioned in the intro, you are the highest profile individual that's ever come into the inside the Opium Den. You're the very first journalist I've called and communicated with all journalists who write about drug policy, and none have taken the invitation, and you have. And being that you're the most prominent investigative journalist in Canada, myself and probably many of my listeners are wondering why you decided to talk to me.
Well, I think it's important. I really think it's very important. As a, I'm originally an American, but I've lived in Canada for more than 30 years, and I know a lot about Mexico. And these, the U.S. war on drugs is totally misguided. It's rooted in a puritanical morality that's irrelevant, and it's ruining. It's ruining the societies in the transshipment countries. Canada is kind of staying on top of it and kind of permitting it through the decriminalization of marijuana possession, and possession really of a lot of drugs. And even large quantities. Mexico is actually getting absolutely ravaged and ruined, as Colombia did. And so the war on drugs is creating huge problems in the hemisphere and in the world, I would submit, because you get enormous profits. And any interdiction, any crackdown, any time a shipment, a gigantic shipment of cocaine or heroin or marijuana is interdicted and impounded, the value on the street goes up. It's a supply-demand. It's a commodity. It's a product. And, you know, the usage of these things is not a matter of morality. I think it's a matter of, if it's excessive and addictive, I think it's a mental health issue. And if it's not, it's nobody's business. But that's aside from the point that, you know, America is spending hundreds of millions of dollars every year on the war, so-called war on drugs, just so that, you know, crown attorneys and DAs can look like they're doing their job. You're putting people in jails. You're tying up police work, and you're not attacking the health issue.
Well, now,
and so I don't see any redeeming quality at all. And I would say that it should be decriminalized, treated as a health issue, but marijuana, I think, should be legal. Period.
Well,
just
I think
like, it's no different than alcohol.
Right. Well, there are differences. I will attest, but you're right that as far as an intoxicant, marijuana is certainly no worse than alcohol, and there's a good argument that can be made that
it's not as harmful.
That it's not as harmful,
and,
correct.
And we know that alcohol during Prohibition, the prohibition of it, it's really the old movie. The old movie was that the organized criminal elements, that, which included Joseph Kennedy, and the
let's not forget Joseph Kennedy.
Joseph Kennedy was a bootlegger.
Right, of course.
And he had operations in Canada and offshore Pierre Miquelon, which is part of a French of the French government. And that's where he set up his stuff, and he shipped it to the U.S. border. And the mafia grew up to take care of business at home. So, you know, it did nothing to stop consumption. And what it did was it created a huge criminal element in the United States and around the United States. And this is the same movie. And for the same reasons that Prohibition was lifted, because A, it didn't work, and B, what was wrong with alcohol if it was used sensibly, and C, these criminal elements became, you know, enormous. You know, it was gotten rid of. We should do the same thing with certainly with marijuana.
Well, drug prohibition is the sequel to the movie Alcohol Prohibition
absolutely,
that you're speaking
absolutely.
Of. But my question is, you seem to be, you know, very much in favor of at minimum decriminalizing it and at best legalizing marijuana consumption, the cultivation and the consumption for personal use. But I have a question with regards to comparing the two movies. Do you have a certain reticence about removing prohibitions against all drugs, or is it just marijuana that you're most comfortable with?
Well, I think that, you know, I'm comfortable with the marijuana, and that's because it is the least harmful. Things like heroin and cocaine. But, you know, look, let's be honest. This is a health issue. This should be just a health issue, that people that overuse and abuse anything, whether it's alcohol, prescription drugs, is one of the biggest addiction problems in the United States and around the world, the abuse of legal pharmaceuticals. It's a matter of quantity, and it's a matter of health, mental health in the user. And so I really think that the whole area could be rethought. And I would, in Canada, for instance, our heroin addicts are treated as patients, which is what they are. They are given methadone, and now the big debate in Ontario, where Toronto is that actually methadone probably isn't the right thing to do, but we should be giving them heroin.
Well, I agree with that.
Under a doctor's supervision.
Well,
it's
I don't
a health
know.
Issue. This is not recreational.
Well,
we're talking about people that use a lot of this substance, and it is addictive.
Well, I agree with you to a certain point there, but to say that, you know, heroin addiction or cocaine addiction should be administered by a physician kind of is a little, I don't know what the word is, but we don't have our alcoholics going to doctors to mitigate or manage their alcoholism. They're able to self-medicate in almost all regards. So I'm not so certain that we should have a separate yet equal type of program.
I would argue that alcoholics should also be under supervision, and many of them are here. And, you know, certainly
alcohol
in the workplace. They become a hazard. People that are on these substances are a hazard to themselves, to their family, the workplace, the roads. You know, they should be supervised, and their usage should be carefully controlled. And if it's if they're absolutely, totally addicted to it, then something else, some kind of intervention should be involved, like analysis or whatever. But the point is that, you know, I think that, let's just get to the U.S. war on drugs. I don't know how many people are in jail right now because of marijuana. That's ridiculous.
Well, it's a significant portion of our prison population.
Hundreds of thousands of people a year go to jail because of marijuana.
We arrest every year in the United States. We arrest over 800,000 individuals, mostly younger people, over 800,000 for the simple possession of marijuana. So we have a significant issue in that regard. Now, not all of them end up
Then they have a criminal record.
That's correct. Not all
and
of them.
And that affects their lives.
Absolutely. It puts a stain on their record moving forward.
Can't become a cop, can't become a lawyer, probably can't become a teacher, a nurse.
It's a disincentive for success. They have a tremendous disadvantage in the business market, the employment market, and just the public opinion market. But
yeah, it's just stupid.
It's really stupid.
Now, in Canada, we would legalize it. I really believe we would, and we virtually have. It's decriminalized. I mean, nobody has gone to jail for years for possession.
But you still look for the people with large quantities, correct?
Well, because they're breaking the law by taking it to the border and doing that sort of thing. They're breaking the law, and there's a tax evasion issue too. But even then, I mean, I was on a couple of drug busts 4 years ago when I did my three-part series on marijuana in British Columbia. And I was on a drug bust, and they have this van called the Grow Busters, and it's got big painted nut signage on the side. I mean, there's a bunch of them. And these squads go around to grow ops, which are in homes. And one home was a modest home in a lousy neighborhood, and one home was a mansion in a great neighborhood. And their basements were, you know, boarded up. They were hydroponic. And they were using huge amounts of electricity, and there were suspicious goings on. So it was either the neighbors turning them in or the electricity situation. So they go. This is what they do. They target these houses, and they put a ram, you know, and they drive up in this truck with signage.
Oh, yeah.
They honk the horn.
Right. It's crazy.
They ram the door. And the first house, I looked around and I said, there's some people running out the back. He said, good, we don't want to catch them. It's pointless. If we catch them, it goes to court. They have to book them, all the paperwork, and they never go to jail.
Yeah, they're primarily arrested in a disruptive type of procedure as opposed to...
Well, I'm talking about people that are... So they were mostly Vietnamese people seemed to be recruited into this. And there were about seven or eight people in each home. And they were allowed to get away and run out the back. You know, they're the little people. They're just workers. But inside, there was $1 million worth of plants or more.
Well, let me ask you this, Diane.
And so they would, in the U.S., that would be a great bust. They'd have, you know, the SWAT team. They'd sneak up on the house. They'd arrest people. The district attorney would hold a press conference and say, aren't I a great guy? The stats would look good that year when he ran for re-election or whatever. We made so many more arrests where our war on drugs is working.
Well, of course, we have all that hyperbolic activity going on in the press. But let me ask you this,
That's
Diane.
The U.S. We don't have that.
Right.
So the people ran out. They destroyed the plants. They shut down the grow-op.
Right.
And, you know.
It had no impact whatsoever. But I would like to ask you a question with regards to your belief on decriminalization.
We should have legalized it a long time ago in Canada. Because that's how we do it. because we haven't, we have to shut these things down because, again, it's a hazard to the health and the workers.
Right, but
we don't because the Americans would go nuts.
Well, we do go nuts on that.
We legalized it.
Right. Well, we didn't go nuts on Portugal, and they have a legalization scheme very similar to what Mexico just passed. We didn't go nuts on them. We went nuts initially on Amsterdam because of their laissez-faire policy. But I want to ask you, I want to get your thoughts on this. When you say it should be, you know, decriminalized for, you know, for the average individual to have small amounts for possession and smoking it, but we should go after the people who provide that. Isn't there some kind of weird?
No, I think we should legalize marijuana.
But the current situation is not that way. Both in the United States and in Canada, we still continue to go after those who supply all of the individual people with their small quantities of marijuana. And I think that's silly. It's like it's okay to have a six-pack of beer, but we're going to arrest all the Coors truck drivers bringing it to the groceries.
They just don't bother to do it. They're not bothering to do it. So what they do in Canada is this insane business of shutting down grow-ops and let the workers get away.
But that's had no impact on the supply of marijuana.
Right. Not at all. This is a gigantic country. It's very liberal. And, you know, they go up into mountains. They go into factories that are vacant. People are doing it in their homes. You can't stop it.
Well, let me ask you this. The piece that you wrote that got my attention, which was very well written, The U.S. War on Drugs is Ravaging Mexico. It was Tuesday, August 11th in the National Post there. And what got my attention was that you called the meeting of Stephen Harper and Felipe Calderon and Barack Obama, you called it the Three Amigos Summit. And I thought that was very apropos because, as you may know, there was a movie called The Three Amigos that starred Martin Short, who I believe is a Canadian, Chevy Chase, and Steve Martin.
Yeah.
And there were some parallels, though, but that caught my attention right off the bat. So we have Canada, which has a fairly laissez-faire approach to marijuana. We have Mexico, marijuana. We have Mexico, where they have decriminalized the personal use possession of all drugs across the board. And then we have the United States in the center of this drug sandwich. What do you think of Barack Obama?
Which is the market.
Which is the market, correct. What do you think of Barack Obama and his drug policies as they are unfolding in his young administration?
You know what? You're going to have to inform me because I don't follow every twist and turn of U.S. Pronouncements from the White House. It seems to me that he sort of said, you know, he's not a Puritan on it, but on the other hand, he said we can't, legalizing is not a possible, or that's what I remember.
Yeah, it's not. As you probably know, in his book, he admitted to smoking a lot of marijuana and snorting a lot of cocaine, and it certainly didn't seem to impede his ability to achieve success as an older individual.
He abused alcohol and stopped doing that, and he stopped doing all those things.
Yes, but
addicted to cigarettes, I think.
Well, yeah, he's
big
still
deal.
Yeah, big deal. But see, but as Canada, come on, Diane, let's get him. But as candidate Obama, he made some very very enlightened comments that made a lot of people in the United States pay attention with regard to drug policy.
He gets it, but he's dragging along, you know.
I don't think he does get it.
Half a country that thinks very differently than you and I do and your listeners.
What do you mean by that?
Well, people who voted for McCain and Palin. I mean, where are their heads?
Oh, well, they're up their
on
ass.
This issue.
But excuse my French. But President Obama should know better. As a candidate, he said that he is on record on multiple YouTubes of saying that the war on drugs has been an abject failure. We need to reorient the way we do things. He was also on record
as... Well, that's great. Good.
Well, that's great, but, you know, he's the typical politician in that regard. He says all these nice things, but then when it comes to actual action, again, another one of his promises as a candidate was that he would facilitate a program to supply clean needles to IV drug users.
Right.
That was a very big thing. It was ideology versus science, and he was taking the science position. So a lot of people who are very very active in want drug policy reform in the United States took those issues to heart and felt that we actually were going to have some type of change. But we have not seen that in specifically in his legislation.
The United States is not a dictatorship.
No, it is not.
You have checks and balances.
Right.
He can't even get health care, for God's sake, passed in Congress with a majority of his own party who are in favor of it.
But he's botched that debate from the get-go.
What is very important as an observer and an ex-American or ex-American resident, I'm still American, is that the United States is an enormous steamship, like a big freighter. And to turn that boat, somebody's got to start to say we're going to turn it, and it can take a long time to turn it. This is the first president, I think, who's actually said those things.
It is
the beginning of the end of the policies that don't work, in my estimation. It may take two more terms. It may take California careening off and doing its own thing, or more likely Washington and Oregon. But it's the beginning of the change, and I think it's demographic.
Well, 76% in a recent Zogby poll here in the United States, 76% of Americans believe that drug prohibition has failed. So I believe we have reached the tipping point with regard to public belief.
Then it may happen, but 76% of Congress is not ready to vote to legalize stuff.
Well, the interesting thing about that, Diane, is that when we speak to our elected leaders in private, almost to a person, they agree that drug prohibition has failed, but they're afraid to stand up because they believe their constituents will shout them down. And then we have the American public who believe strongly that drug prohibition has failed, but they're afraid to speak up because, one, they don't want retribution from employers, neighbors. So everybody's afraid to speak up. It's like the 800-pound gorilla in the room, that everybody in the public, or a large percentage of the public, agree that drug prohibition has failed. Most of our elected leaders believe it.
I think most Americans are like most people in the world. It's sort of live and let live.
Of course.
Here's another explanation as to why it doesn't change.
Okay.
And I can't prove this. What prohibition did was it created multinational criminal organizations. Okay? And this is creating multinational parallel corporations. These people do not want it legalized. They don't want to pay taxes. They don't want to reduce the price. They don't want to compete openly. They like it the way it is. They are paying off people to oppose it, is my guess. So I think that may be even bigger an impediment than public opinion.
Well, I think one of the biggest impediments is that the drug warriors have just as much a stake in the game as the drug dealers do. We have a huge global enterprise infrastructure set up to fight the war on drugs. So we've got the drug warriors who have a vested interest in maintaining the status quo, and we have the drug cartels interested in maintaining the status quo for their individuals.
And they're paying off the politicians, possibly.
Without question, I think you see a tremendous amount of that in Mexico, and I don't know how much it has migrated north.
Well, I'm sure Congress. It explains why Congress is that way. That plus, you know, ideological born-agains who are opposed to anything like this and want to tell everybody how to live their lives. That's another ideological problem you have in the U.S., which is quite unique, except for third world countries where there's fundamental religions that run things.
You've got
a bunch of problems, and I think you've also got... But what is to stop? You tell me. What is to stop an enlightened state government from saying it's going to be legal? Can the Fed stop that?
Well, actually, in California, since 1996, Proposition 215 legalized medical marijuana for the state of California. With that, Diane, and you asked what I thought, the problem with that is that the DEA and with the help of local police agencies continue to arrest people who grow, people who dispense, and people who use. Even after Barack Obama, one of his campaign promises was that he would order the DEA to stand down, at least in the 13 states where medical marijuana laws are on the books. There were no, he has not. He didn't initially.
Well,
there were six.
That's ridiculous.
Well, it is, but there were a number of arrests in California. Barack Obama, President Obama, then did say, "We're not going to do this anymore." And subsequent to that order to the DEA, there have been three additional arrests. So when you talk about the states taking the lead, we have 13 states in here in America that have taken the lead, but we need the help of the administration to honor the states' rights issue. But the DEA is, I don't want to call them a rogue agency, but they're very close to a rogue agency. They do what they want to do in direct violation of an order from the President of the United States. So we have a serious issue with regards to the states being able to take the lead. They have taken the lead. As I mentioned, 13 states have medical marijuana laws on the books, but the federal government continues to allow the DEA to assist, and I use that word in quotes, local law enforcement in busting and disrupting the growing and the distribution of marijuana to medical patients. So it's a mess.
It's an enormous problem. I mean, it's a very big country, and it's difficult to govern because it's democratic and it's splintered. Your power is splintered in a parliamentary system like we have and like Europe has. You know, when you get a majority government, you've virtually got a dictatorship. You can get thrown out. People can get upset. But you can do what you want to do. You can drive the bus more efficiently. That can also be a problem.
Yes, it can.
If you don't drive it straight. So, I think the U.S. is a wonderful country. It's a great country. But this is a very tricky business. It's very controversial. And
controversial to whom?
Healthcare.
I mean, now, excuse me for interrupting, but back up a minute. Controversial to whom? Controversial among the political class or the electorate?
I don't know. Well, you tell me. It's very controversial.
Well, it is not as controversial as you would believe. As I mentioned, 76% of Americans believe drug prohibition has failed.
So, what about editorial op-ed pieces, editorial policy among the media?
I'm glad you brought that up.
Are they in favor of legalizing? I don't think I've ever seen any.
You're going to find them come out. Well, no, the LA Times has been probably the closest to agreeing that legalization should be the answer across the board. But surprisingly, the one newspaper, my favorite newspaper actually, is the Wall Street Journal. I've been a reader and subscriber for close to 30 years now, and there's a reporter for the journal. Her name is Mary Anastasia O'Grady, and Mary has written extensively about the drug war in Colombia and Mexico. She's an expert like you on Mexico and Latin America, and she is very, very courageous, as you are, to speak your mind and her mind about the futility of the drug war. So we have a tremendous amount of, I won't say a tremendous amount, that's an overstatement.
The Economist did a piece on it.
Right. There have been numerous high-profile articles and pieces written about the drug war that
changing. The world is
right, and you read between the lines, you can see that there's a great frustration with the status quo out there. But unlike most popular movements that are grassroots from the ground up, I believe that the drug prohibition issue is a top-down program, and that's why I was very excited for Barack Obama to become president, because, you know, his science over ideology, his very definitive statements about drugs and the drug war lent a lot of people, you know, especially a lot of young people who may not have made that their number one issue.
When did he promise to call the DEA off in those 13 states? During the presidential election campaign?
During the presidential campaign, he said that the DEA he didn't believe that the DEA had the legal authority to continue to conduct these raids in states where medical marijuana laws are on the books.
Okay.
You know, thank God for YouTube, because YouTube's all over. I would suggest that
the state's attorneys in those 13 states are falling down on their jobs if they're not legally contesting this. And why aren't they? If they're harassing people that are doing something that's legalized in their state, and they're allowing the federal government, I would hope that there's litigation and there's fighting going on in those 13 states.
Well, part of the problem, Diane, is that the statutes as they were written have a certain amount of ambiguity and vagueness to them, and that DEA and local law enforcement have been exploiting that that ambiguity in some of these, in the way some of these laws have been written, and they're saying, well, we know that it's okay to have medical marijuana. That's not why we're busting you. We're busting you because your tax records aren't proper, or your application to become a dispenser, you know, had some errors. So they're using these technical issues, which they are saying back to President Obama and Eric Holder, who's our Attorney General. They're saying, look, we think medical marijuana is okay. We're not doing it because of that. We're doing it because their application process was wrong, or we think they're avoiding taxes. So they're using a variety of superficial reasons to go in there and do it. And President Obama and Eric Holder, even Gil Kerlikowske, who is our new drug czar, they tend to stand aside from that. Now, I want to bring up one.
That's funny in itself. You have a drug czar. I mean, come on.
Yeah, really.
Columbia has a drug czar, but he's a criminal.
Right, right.
Drug czar. And, stupid.
In ours,
I mean,
is,
really, it's pejorative. I mean, the language has got to change. People
well, they did. They did
are
change.
Not bad people. They are sick people. People who want to use recreational drugs are not bad people. They're doing what people who drink a beer are doing.
Exactly.
You know? I mean, the whole language is just wrong.
Well, let me ask you a question here. Back prior to 1914, when the United States passed the Harrison Narcotics Act, all of these substances were readily available. You could buy heroin from the Sears Roebuck catalog.
Coca-Cola was cocaine-based.
Yeah, there was cocaine, a slight trace of cocaine in Coca-Cola. All this happened prior to 1914. If you look at the ads, the copywriters in these in Sears Roebuck catalogs, they spoke very highly of the potential of these drugs to cure, to be curative, to be even recreational, and to be very beneficial. At that time, when these drugs were readily accessible, you could buy them at the grocery store, corner drug stores, Sears Roebuck catalog. They were high potency. They weren't adulterated like we find our street drugs to be now. They were very readily available. They were pure. They were cheap. And we were actually recommended to take these drugs. Back then, our addiction rate was no greater than it is today, which is less than 2%. But the most salient point is we had virtually no drug crime. None when these substances were freely and legally available.
Exactly.
So I'm asking
every time a cop makes a bust, the value to the dealers and the distributors goes up.
Generally speaking, if it's a significant enough impact on it.
But you've affected supply.
My question to you then would be I kind of get the impression that you would not support full repeal of drug prohibition, but given those facts that we had no zero drug crime back in those days, and again, I want to emphasize we were encouraged to take these substances, back that we had no drug crime and our addiction rate is still the same as it was back then, less than 2%, why would you not be in favor of repealing all drug prohibition and putting a regulated market to control the sale and distribution of these substances, very similar to what we have now for alcohol and tobacco. What is your point against that?
I don't know enough about cocaine and heroin and some of the other drugs to know how physically harmful they can be. I think that you've got to do it incrementally. And that's why I would say the first step would be to legalize marijuana, tax it, regulate it, and then with the other stuff, do what we're doing. And that is people would come forward who say, I can't stop using it, and it's a problem, it's affecting my life, and then you put them on a program through heroin and cocaine. I don't know how harmful these things are.
Well, they're
very harmful.
Well, they are and they are not. They're a benign substance, and it really depends upon the utilization of them. Cocaine has been proven, if you look past all the hysteria, cocaine is not as an addictive substance as it is purported to be. Yes, it is an addictive substance. Yes, opiates are addictive. But it's in degrees and shades. Many of our prohibitionists will tell you that after that first, you snort one line of cocaine and baby, you're hooked. And that's why this is such a terribly bad drug. But those are not the facts. Back in President Jimmy Carter, who was certainly not a conservative type of deal. He was a pretty liberal guy. He had a drug commission set up, and they recommended that marijuana be decriminalized, if not legalized. And they also said that the problem with cocaine is not nearly what we consider it to be, and that Jimmy Carter's drug czar, who wasn't really called a drug czar, but he was his fellow on drugs, said that the moderate recreational use of cocaine did not lead to addiction, and in fact was a pleasurable exercise similar to other intoxicating substances. So it's
well,
just it's been the hyperbole.
I think there's a physiological difference. First of all, people that smoke crack, you smoke it, right? Crack or
right.
Take heroin or cocaine. If they're addicts, why wouldn't they just switch to alcohol? It would cost them a tenth as much money. If it wasn't drug specific to the physiology of the person, the addiction gets. I'm not an expert on this, but it seems to me drinking, you know, 8 bottles of Plonk a day wine is a lot cheaper and less would lead to less criminality than someone who's hooked on crack or heroin where it's $800 a day.
Well, unfortunately,
like, it doesn't make sense. They don't seem to be able to switch products. They don't seem to be able to go from the illegal to the legal, and that worries me because I think there's something intrinsic in the drug that's a problem.
Oh, yes, there is something intrinsic.
I mean?
Just like tobacco rewires the brain, alcohol rewires the brain, opiates and stimulants do the same thing. I've known...
Why can't they switch?
Well, I'll explain that to you, at least from my understanding. I've known many heroin addicts and cocaine addicts, whether snorting or smoking. And they wish that alcohol would do the trick for them. They truly do. I mean, they don't choose to live
so
a life of...
there is some problem with the intrinsic nature of the drug.
Well, it's not so much the drug itself.
Or it won't let go of them.
Well, tobacco is the most insidious drug as far as holding on to someone. It's not an intoxicant, but it is the most addictive drug we have.
Well, then they should smoke 4 packs a day.
But it's not going to ring their bell, Diane. That's the point that I'm trying to make.
That's the issue. That's the point I'm making. So they can't switch.
No, they cannot.
There's something intrinsically harmful about that particular drug.
Well, I don't know if it's that particular drug or it's the fact that their body chemistry, I mean, it's a fairly well-established fact in medical science, unless you're, you know, on one end or the other, that drug addiction is a disease. We have a genetic predisposition to a certain type of drug.
And
genetic predisposition to heroin, genetic predisposition to cocaine, genetic predisposition to alcohol, because many people can have a beer or two and their brain tells them, okay, that's enough. Same thing with cocaine. You can snort a couple lines and your brain says, okay, pleasure is good. Now don't do anymore for a while. When the switch, when your internal wiring is not correct, that's what allows the addict, regardless of its substance, to continue to use to the point where they cannot stop. So many addicts would love to switch.
If that's the case, what we need in 10 years' time, hopefully, is we need all this stuff legalized, and people should be tested for predispositions. And if they have a genetic proclivity toward it, or they're already addicted, then that's a medical issue. And they should be supervised, go through kind of programs to try and watch what they're doing and have total abstinence if they're not already, you know, using. And that would make me very happy.
Well, we have...
That's the way it should be.
Well, I'm sure in Canada, because people are the same throughout the world, we have functioning alcoholics. We all know them. We work with them. They're our relatives. They're our friends. The problem I have with the monitoring scheme that you've proposed is that I don't think people are going to say to the government, look, I can drink a couple of beers a day and I can monitor my own usage, and it's not your business, or it's not my responsibility to come to the government and say, well, I'm drinking a little bit more alcohol than before, or saying, well, I've gone from a half a pack of cigarettes to a full pack of cigarettes, or I've gone from just snorting cocaine on the weekends to maybe, you know, snorting a little bit on a Wednesday. I don't think a monitoring program, especially if it were to include alcohol, and the only way it would be fair is if it did include alcohol. How many of your friends that drink do you think would subject themselves to some type of government program to monitor their alcohol consumption?
Well, you know, a lot of people are in denial, and I don't think alcoholics ever function. I think they may be able to do their job and make a living, but look at the statistics on road accidents, marriages, abuse. I mean, just go to an Al-Anon meeting and you'll see the collateral damage to everybody around an alcoholic.
Oh, I don't doubt that, but we do
so
have
what
function.
What I'm saying is that there has to be monitoring. Society cannot allow people to swing their arm. You can't have the freedom to swing your arm if it's going to hurt and hit somebody else. And that's the bottom line. So that's why I say anybody who's addicted should be supervised medically.
Including alcohol?
Everything.
Okay.
Oh, sure. Listen, people handling heavy equipment can endanger their colleagues.
I'm certainly not.
It's a real problem.
I'm certainly not for a free for all situation.
Yeah.
Way past. I mean, I'm not even close to that. I'm for the repeal of drug prohibition, but I'm also for increasing the responsibilities that go along with that. I believe that we should have sober bus drivers and sober airline pilots, whether it's alcohol, cocaine, heroin. But an interesting sidebar to that, when you're talking about operating.
Well, what that means is the workplace testing.
I'm totally opposed to workplace testing across the board, unless it is.
I don't want my airplane pilot to be drunk or stoned.
Well, let me ask you this. Your Air Force, the Canadian Air Force, the United States Air Force, and literally every Air Force around the world supplies their pilots with amphetamines. Every pilot that goes up into the air in that cockpit has amphetamines in his flight jacket. And the reason they give them amphetamines...
That's interesting. I didn't know that.
That's an absolute fact. I went to college to be an Air Force fighter pilot, so I'm very, very cognizant of how those things work.
Truck drivers use it, too.
Truck drivers use it as well. So the point is, from the military standpoint, is that if you get tired or a little groggy up there, you're flying this, you know, $55 million aircraft. If you start to get a little drowsy, don't fight it. Take the amphetamines, and you'll be able to control yourself. So there is a value in certain occupations for having the access to
performance enhancing
drugs.
So do you allow drugs in the Olympics?
Drugs are rampant in the Olympics. The dopers are always two-step. Should I be allowed? I think we should allow it.
One with drugs and one without.
Exactly.
World records should be based on whether they were enhanced.
Very
or
good
not
point.
Enhanced.
An absolutely very good point. We should have parallel Olympics. We should have all the steroid eaters and the dopers on one side and the natural guys on the other side. And what do you think will get most of the advertising revenue? The freaks, of course. They'll get all the deal. But
that's another thing too. If I were to legalize everything, I'm not going to let these guys advertise.
Absolutely not. Absolutely not.
Like the cigarette and the booze boys.
Absolutely not.
We do not allow cigarette or booze ads in our magazines, newspapers.
They don't need the advertising.
They're not even allowed to corporately sponsor tennis matches, car races.
Yeah, I think again, a very smart point. These type of intoxicants, especially the addictive ones, they don't need the help of advertising. People are going to seek them out and do them. And I think all advertising for alcohol, tobacco should be restricted. And most of the people that I speak with in drug policy reform and I've tried to establish.
We don't let pharmaceuticals be advertised in Canada. Illegal. No pharmaceuticals. I go down to the U.S. and I'm watching TV or I open up a magazine and they're pumping some kind of pharma product at me that, you know, is to deal with a problem I never even heard of. So it makes me go to my doctor and say, "Do I need some of this?" And the doctor says, "Yeah."
Well, I agree with you. I wouldn't have pharmaceuticals.
Nobody
should be. Drugs should not be advertised in newspapers and things like that. Now, with the advent of the web, obviously they could have their own websites where. You know, if you got a headache, go to this website. But as far as newspaper, television, weekly magazines.
Mass media should stay.
Absolutely, mass media.
Now, do you know what that does to another whole sector, industry, the media industry? And, I mean, there was a big hue and cry, and a couple of magazines folded in Canada because they were reliant on cigarette and booze ads.
Right, right. Well,
you know, there's a lot of people with a vested interest in keeping this stuff illegal.
Well, I believe
that's
there are, but there are also a lot of people with a vested interest in repealing prohibition. And I think that those outside of the cartels, let's exclude the cartels, but everybody else who has a vested interest, the drug warriors, the people who supply drug testing equipment to schools, those people have a vested interest.
Absolutely.
But we have a large again, it's a very silent majority, like Nixon used to refer to, a very silent majority in the United States who believes that we are on the wrong track with regards to
with
drugs.
And live and let live.
And they want to live and let live, but again, it's that catch-22. The politicians believe the same thing, but they're afraid to stand up for being, and they'll be accused of being soft on drugs. And then the people in the country are afraid to stand up because they think their neighbor is going to look at them like, oh my God. One of the most interesting things that I have found as I traveled around the country and give lectures on drug prohibition is that people will come up to me and say, you know what? I couldn't believe it. I talked to a friend at work and they about smoking pot, and they said they smoked pot too. I couldn't believe it. And that's what people are finding. When they do start to talk about this with their friends, they're finding that they're going, wow, you smoke pot too? So, I mean, 100 million people in the United States have used recreational drugs, and right now about 45 million Americans get high on a semi-regular basis in the United States. That is a tremendously large number of people. So obviously you're going to meet your coworkers and your friends and things like that actually...
So walking around Toronto or Vansterdam, as we call Vancouver, or Montreal, or go to a rock concert. I was in a rock concert recently. You don't have to light up to smoke.
It's a contact high. It's everywhere.
Coldplay had a concert in Toronto 2 weeks ago. And this is inside where smoking is not permitted. Cigarette smoking is not permitted. Cops were, you know, at the gates. I mean, it's a very peaceful country. And it's like everywhere. Like, who cares?
It's ubiquitous.
Everybody gets a little buzz.
Right.
The music sounds better, and no harm's done.
And they go home, and the sex is better.
And they drive their car more safely than if they have three beers.
That, you know, Diana, I'm going to like you a little bit more. That's exactly, you've made three very salient good points, very good observations. People under the influence of marijuana tend to drive better than those under the influence of a little bit of alcohol.
Well,
they tend to drive
slower.
Well,
if you get stoned on marijuana, you can't find your car keys.
Now, that's a stereotype, Diane.
You drive too slowly, which can also be hazardous, but alcohol and driving? It's a killer.
Yeah, and stimulants. I would much rather follow somebody who's done about three or four lines of cocaine than someone who has drank four or five beers. The cocaine user might drive a little faster, but he's going to stay between the lines. There's just no question about that, where the alcohol consumer is going to be
alcohol
a little bit
is an unmitigated disaster, and it's legal and the other isn't. I think the other thing, too, that's very important, and it's a point that I've written about a lot in Canada and in the U.S., and I really think that there's no difference between the majority of Americans and Canadians and Europeans, and that is that I think we are basically economic conservatives and social liberals, and that is consistent. Being a social conservative, in other words, thou shalt not do this and thou shalt not do that, and you can't have a choice if you're a woman and you're pregnant, you can't smoke marijuana, you can't do this, you can't do that, is not consistent with economic conservatism. And economic conservatism, keep the government out of the economy, free enterprise, let me get on with it as long as I don't hurt people. And that's where people are socially as well. So the fact that, you know, the Republican Party, for instance, or the Conservative Party in Canada, we have a small element of social conservatives in there, and they're usually highly religious people. They don't belong in that party because they want to introduce the governments into the bedroom, not the boardroom. I'm saying I don't want them in the boardroom, and I don't want them in the bedroom.
Don't you think?
We need them.
How do you classify religion as far as a drug? Do you think it's one of the worst drugs?
Well, the mainstream religions are very liberal in Canada. You know, the United Church. I mean, anything goes. They were the first in the world to marry gay people. They gay ministers. I mean, very liberal. The mainstream Protestants. So it's kind of live and let live. It's very, very liberal. And most Canadians do not go to church. So we're like Europeans. We're very secularized. Most, you know, a lot of Americans go to church, but they go to these mainstream churches, and I don't think it's very different. And I think in the U.S., church going is very often a social thing.
Yes, yeah, I agree.
You move around, you move cities, you plug into a church. It's like a poor man's country club. I'm serious.
I agree with you.
And that's what you do.
I
don't think it's you know, ultra fanatical or anything like that.
No, we certainly.
But there is an element that are very powerful in the U.S. that are very fundamentalist.
That's true. I think that they're losing some of that allure, as you probably witnessed. George W. Bush for 8 years paid nothing more than lip service to the evangelical movement, and as a result, they have lessened their importance on the political in the political arena. Again, with the Democrats in power, they tend to be a little more muted. But
I think so. And fundamentalists are a problem in every country. So
yeah, they're all crazy.
Well, any religion.
Any religion is it? Was it Marx that said religion is the opiate of the masses? I believe it was.
Yeah.
Well, Diane, we have exceeded your time limit that you graciously allowed.
I know. I got going. I really enjoyed this chat because you know what? I've learned some things. It's helped me focus my mind on some of the policy side shows, issues, and it's given me a lot more clarity, and I'm going to be writing about it. And I write in the Huffington Post in the United States.
I do. I followed, once I found out, once I read your Three Amigos article, I spent an afternoon reading a lot of your stuff, and I must say that even though you're admittedly a self-taught writer, which many people would not make that admission, so I have a lot of respect for you for that. In that regard, you do write very well. And I'm going to thank you again for coming inside the Opium Den. I'm going to send you
and good for you, and keep the conversation going. And I do think that you have a president who's 45 years old who gets it. And I think it's complicated, but I think it'll eventually happen.
Well, I appreciate your optimism, and I think it will eventually happen as well. Again, Diane Francis, one of the most prominent and respected financial journalists in Canada, thank you very much for coming inside the Opium Den today. We wish you all the very best.
Thank you.
Bye now. Well, there you have it, Den Heads. Diane Francis, one of the, as I mentioned several times, one of the most prominent and respected financial journalists in Canada. We picked her brain today with regards to drugs. I thought she was very brave of her to come on the show because drug policy is not her cup of tea, but she had the courage and the fun-minded spirit to come on and speak with us today. So again, August 24th, 2009, our interview inside the Opium Den with Diane Francis. Thanks for listening. And as we like to say at the conclusion of all of our programs, when good people obey bad law never changes.